This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and Bill Teeple. That's me. Recording from the Icon Gallery on the Fairfield Square in Fairfield, Iowa. Okay, Donna, you got a topic for us today?
Yes, I was very interested. The Ellsworth Kelly film that we saw on video night was very intriguing to me for several reasons. One, because a lot of it took place in Paris, and so that made me feel nostalgia for many of my favorite places there. But the thing that I'd like to talk about today, which I've been thinking about ever since, is his remarkable ability to look at some complex structure and see kind of the skeleton of it, see the essentials of the form.
And insert here before I lose it that I had a transformation of seeing things just by watching that video. Because I started to see more the way he sees after having watched that video, because I think everybody has a different way of seeing the information coming in, and I started to see those overall basic shapes, which is not necessarily what I'm seeing when I'm taking in the information. And I felt like I had become him a little bit.
Yeah.
So go ahead. I had the same experience. It was very interesting.
See, I think the brilliance of the filmmaker is what brought that about, because the exact same thing happened to me. And I thought it was a beautiful way they did it in the film, where they would show you the building that he was looking at, and then they would show you the drawing or the painting that he had made based on what he saw. And they were so beautiful, even though when you originally looked at the building, you didn't even see it. It was like two air ducts on the side of some nondescript building, not a thing of beauty at all. And yet he extracted from that something remarkable. And then the mileage that he got out of these images, too, and the variations that he made on that, those very, very simple things. So anyway, I would like to talk about that today, about the complexity of life and the need in many different contexts to simplify it, and how difficult that is for most people. And, you know, anyway, there's a lot of different directions we could go with this.
Simplification is a pet topic of mine. As a computer person, one of the things I deal with a lot is problems in operating systems and software that are born of unnecessary or out of control complexity. And I think humans, you know, have a tendency to think a lot and to make things complicated. And for some reason, it's much easier. Well, I can see why. I think it's easier to make things complicated, because in a sense, complication is just an accretion of viewpoints and concepts and ideas without necessarily any orderliness to it or order. Whereas simplification requires some kind of understanding of an inherent structure. And you can't boil it down to its essential nature if you don't understand it. But you can talk about it endlessly if you don't understand it. In fact, that's what we tend to do.
The less we understand,
well, especially here, but the less you understand something, the more you talk about it. And the more you understand something, the less there is to say about it other than, wow.
Well, just another example that in my art teaching, I have to teach, especially in teaching watercolor, there's a language of watercolor that requires simplification. And it's very, very difficult for the student. I teach students a step-by-step process to analyze a photograph or the image before you into the game plan that's necessary to do a watercolor, which is doing the lights behind and the soft edges, and then the middle tones and the shapes, and then the detail on top. But you have to have a game plan to do a watercolor. But the most difficult thing is to boil down all of the information just in a photograph, which is only a bit of the information that you're taking in with your eyes, into a watercolor language, which is very simplified. And that's the hardest thing to teach. And then I'll keep going on here. The other thing that came up in talking is Ellsworth Kelly's ability to extract the mathematical. Compared to other artists, are into creating richness of a field and depth and all the other elements, texture and pattern and all of this. He's very attuned to shape. That's what his work's all about. But what he's noticing in an extremely fine manner is the mathematical harmonics of the shapes he's seen before his eyes. And he would talk about taking the shape and then moving it, sort of playing with it on the page, a little bit this way and that until it was in tune. Well, I know that if a mathematician came along and figured out actually the mathematical curves and all involved and the harmonics of the relationships of the angles, that it would be perfect mathematical relationships would probably be emerging.
And yet what was remarkable in his own description of his relationship to these forms and patterns and all that was that he didn't do any math and he didn't follow any theoretical system. In fact, he was inspired by Hans Arp, who would throw squares of paper randomly on the floor and just use the random pattern. And I love that those designs that Ellsworth Kelly made, where he made just brush strokes, black and white brush strokes on some wood or something like that, and then cut it into little squares and then rearrange them randomly, and they were gorgeous. The randomness of the patterns somehow fell into a beautiful order.
But I think that these perfect that everything is mathematics, mm-hmm. and everything in front of our eyes has perfect mathematical order, mm-hmm. and he is personally extracting something that he's subjectively responding to, and then he's getting inside the beauties of that particular shape.
Yeah,
because
actually,
I'm very much, I find that what they were interested in the times of Arp and the Surrealists, mm-hmm. of the they were dealing with randomness. That was part of the thing, because you can't get away from beauty and perfection of mathematical harmonies, because when you throw that, it's going to fall according to precise mathematical order,
yeah.
and so they got interested in how beautiful the chance happening, mm-hmm. is, and then they worked with that.
I meant to actually say that as a point, you know, in that point about his Ellsworth Kelly's love of this method of randomness, was that he had, when he moved those things in his drawings, or when he was even hanging a work in a museum and he would be across the room and say, okay, lift it up 1 inch. And it's a great huge piece, you know, and they lift it up 1 inch and he looks at it and goes, 3 more inches. And they would raise it up 3 more inches and he would go, that's perfect. And then he explained that, I just know. When it's right, I just know. And you could tell that he did just know.
Well, but I think that he's at least in a, you know, we can talk about it all being perfect mathematical harmony, the entire universe, but he's extracting a particular relationship of objects to one to the other, shapes one to the other, mm-hmm. and he's feeling a harmony. And I find this all the time in making art and in teaching art. I talk about a mathematician could come along and probably describe to us mathematically why one curve in relation to another curve is beautiful. But I don't believe that we should start from that angle, although some artists do. Mm-hmm. I want you to find that fine tuning inside yourself so that you say, yes, it's in tune. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing all the time in composing and in art.
Yeah, in fact, that's in the art classes that I'm teaching, they were really interested in learning composition. And at first I was kind of having a resistance to it because I didn't want to sort of use the quote principles of composition and have them, because the whole emphasis in my art classes is coming, you know, tapping into their own visual language and their own creative voice and all that. But so what I had them do was look at the works of various great artists of different types, artists from the Renaissance or people like Matisse or Chagall or anyone they were interested in looking at, and making sketches of what they saw as the composition. You know, we talked about the print, there's line, there's shape, there's the movement in the eye, there, you know, all these elements. And one of the students was looking at a painting by Matisse that had a lot of design element, a lot of patterns and crisscrosses and, you know, many colors and all that. And she, in looking at it with this angle of the composition, the simplest element of the composition, she started doing this little sketch, and she was pretty much gasping every couple of minutes at, like, oh my, because she saw his choices, you know. Mm-hmm. He chose to make a little line, a little horizontal line right across this face that you barely even noticed when you looked at the whole picture. You know, it's like, why did he do that? And then she saw this vertical line that came down, like right down the middle of this body of this person, the thick black line that he'd put in. And so, and every time she noticed these things, she could see why he did that, what he wanted your eye to do when you looked at this, and how it created a balance and with the shapes in the painting. And she wound up basically doing a master copy of the entire painting because she couldn't stop herself. The bliss was just so great in discovering the choices that this artist had made. So she has gained a love of composition that she wouldn't have gained by just reading, you know, if you do this, this happens, and if you do, you know, and if you put a thing here, you need to put something here. It would have not meant as much to her.
And in studying paintings in that fashion, you realize that every line, but not so much the ornamentation, we might say, but all of the basic shapes and relationships of shape has been highly tuned by the artist in the blocking in stage and the getting the whole thing down there. He's feeling that yes on about almost every relationship in there.
Yeah.
I think this brings up a really fundamental principle too, because although upon analysis we can see all of these relationships and define them and recognize that, you know, 20 completely unrelated artists are manifesting some of the same principles in their work, it's also generally true, I think, that approaching it from the point of view of trying to follow those rules is the last thing that any of those artists was doing, any more than a writer sits down with a book of grammatical rules next to him when he starts writing a story. And the perfect example of it is riding a bicycle. If you tried to explain how to ride a bicycle in terms of the physics and mechanics of it, you'd never get anywhere. In fact, few people realize it unless you get to the point of riding a motorcycle where the whole thing is on a larger scale, but it's the same principles. In order to turn left on a motorcycle, you push with your left arm to the right. And because of a complex series of actions and reactions, the motorcycle ends up tilting to the left, the wheel turns to the left, and you go to the left, and you have wonderful control over it because you're actually pushing to the right to sort of modulate the left turning of the motorcycle. But again, explaining that just sounds illogical, and it's not particularly inspiring, and you would never attempt it. Mathematics, I think, itself is really, in a sense, a description of how the mind is able to find abstract principles in everything. In fact, the nature of the mind's own sort of questing for orderliness, you know, the mechanism of that quest itself. So yes, everything is mathematical, but only if there are people there to mathematicize about it. You know, everything is in infinitely complex harmonious relationships, but the basics of those relationships isn't complex. It's, you know, really simple rules.
Now, that's a very interesting point, because I have always had a great love of mathematics, even though I don't have any desire to sit down and do mathematical formulas. It's more of this sense that what mathematics does is take this incredibly complex, many-layered world and create the simplest language for describing it. Mm-hmm. And somehow just that notion inside myself, when I put my attention on it, gives me great happiness and love of that field of knowledge.
Yeah.
And I even will see in my mind what I call mathematical relationships that have nothing to do with number or even geometric patterns or anything, but somehow I can see these relationships. And it's nourishing and soothing to do that. It's almost like a little form of self-therapy because it takes my attention, just like how we started the show with Ellsworth Kelly, it takes my attention from the complex world around me, that where I may have a lot of questions, doubts, worries, whatever, to this awareness of the perfect order.
Well, what we're getting at here is very interesting, because it has this simplification point that we brought up to begin with. Is sort of the quest, because where the mind, the human intelligence, is looking for the simple and the complex, looking for the pattern there. So this reducing down to a simple pattern underneath all the complexity is what it's the natural tendency of the mind. So that there has to be at the baseline, a simple most simplest state.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all mathematicians in terms of intuition. And it's important to note that mathematics isn't inherently numbers, and it isn't inherently computation. That's what we're taught as being math in school, but mostly we're being taught arithmetic and some algebra, which are just, you know, highly specialized branches of mathematics. And the larger field of math gets along quite nicely without numbers. In fact, number theory is one of the, you know, important branches of mathematics. And when you get into number theory, you're not really dealing much with adding and subtracting or arithmetic kinds of things. And the most, to me, the most exciting branch of mathematics is what's known as foundation theory. And it deals with trying to boil mathematics itself down to the irreducible, most fundamental notions out of which you can build all of mathematics, including set theory and number theory and, you know, these little things we use for computation in everyday life.
So what do they use then in that form of mathematics? Do they use some other form of symbol besides numbers, or how do they?
Oh yeah, numbers are very specialized symbols. Mostly you have to make them up because they're not dealing with counting. Numbers are for counting.
Yeah.
And foundation theory takes you right back to Euclid, who is considered, I think, by most foundation theorists to, you know, be the sort of absolute father of mathematics per se. And Euclid made a series of statements or postulates about, you know, how to start thinking this way. He was kind of inventing mathematics as a mental exercise. And he makes statements like, let there be identities. Let there be relationships between identities. Let there be operations upon identities which can change an aspect of the identity. Now these are, you know, really sort of basic statements. They're finer even than sutras, because they're hardly saying anything, but they're laying this playground. They're sort of setting the first few rules of the playground that turns out to be how the whole mind works.
That is so fascinating. Why didn't they teach us that when we were
third
grade?
My, you know? my dear old friend,
that.
The combinatorial mathematician who dabbles in foundation theory, you know, rants and raves into the wee hours about how, you know, that's not math. They're not even teaching math. No, it's wonderful. And that, you know, Euclid's fifth postulate is now undergoing its like fourth or fifth century of debate by the greatest mathematical minds on the planet to try and settle once and for all whether or not it can be derived from the first four postulates.
Wow.
And is therefore not essential to all of mathematics like the first four clearly are. But it means that math is talking about possibilities of thinking. It's sort of defining the domain of thinking itself.
Yeah.
Look at Gödel's incompleteness theorem, if I may be so bold.
For my bedtime story tonight.
Talking about your Gödel. Gödel's incompleteness theorem essentially is a fancy name for this discovery in mathematics that's, you know, that sort of is derived from thinking about things at their foundation like that. That says that given any internally consistent language for describing things, there will always be statements that you can make that don't break any of the rules of that language, but which make absolutely no sense or which are completely contradictory. And the classic example of this is the Barber of Seville paradox, where you say the Barber of Seville shaves all of the people who live in Seville except the people who shave themselves. Perfectly reasonable statement to make. But then you can ask the question, does the Barber of Seville himself shave himself? If he shaves himself, then he's one of the ones who shaves himself, therefore he's one of the ones he doesn't shave. You know, or a piece of paper that says the statement on the other side is false, and the statement on the other side says the statement on the other side is true. Well, you know, essentially this is a tilt condition. The human pinball machine just gives up and rings a bell and shuts off. And there's nothing you can do about it. But what this tells us on a larger scale is that that language itself cannot describe reality perfectly, no matter at what level of sophistication you build your language. That there's always a gap between language and reality. And that's a pretty profound statement to come out of a field we think of as being characterized by calculators and numbers.
So that, circling back from all of that to Ellsworth Kelly, that explains why you can only see with the precision that he saw, just without even being able to describe what he's doing. In other words, his mind was able to go to that level of simplicity that you just described, that doesn't function based on numbers, calculations, or even words, and see. He had the ability to see at that level that's beyond all of that.
And he connects with the audience on that level.
Yeah.
There's no explanation or intellectualizing or revelation or formula that will tell you what he's doing or help you to access it. It's a direct communication.
Right. Yeah, and one of the other people who were at video night who turned out did not like Ellsworth Kelly's work, and at the end of the movie said to me, I just got nothing out of that. His pieces do nothing for me. And he said they were just too intellectual. And immediately I leaped in and said, are you kidding? They weren't at all intellectual.
Yeah.
He was in love, you know.
Right.
Ellsworth Kelly was in love with the patterns of shadows of, you know, railings on the sidewalk and shadows from a window frame on the wall and all of that. And it was that love that he felt that he put into those works. And so...
Yeah.
You know, we had a little back
and he
forth,
couldn't exhaust his love for the shape. He just kept, he'll take one and just do it for ever and ever.
Yeah.
Well, I think it shows how, you know, although obviously monumental intellect was involved in Gödel's theorem, you know, coming out of mathematics, at the same time, it tells us that there are some things that you can experience. It doesn't say anything about what you can experience unless you postulate that you can only experience that which you can describe. And clearly, describing things does narrow our receptivity to experience. But I think it's pretty clear that there's lots of stuff you can experience that you can't even begin to put into language. And that needn't be a problem.
Yeah, and it's interesting because as you were talking, I was thinking about how intellect is not a bad thing. You know, some people just say, oh, intellectual, it's right. Like they're anti-intellectual people and all that. Well, Ellsworth Kelly, even though he had this intuitive ability and he had this great passion and love for these patterns and forms that he was doing, he was still constantly making choices. And, you know, the discriminative factor that comes from the intellect is part of the choices that artists make. Do I do a line here, or do I do a line, you know, fraction of an inch to the right from here?
Right.
And so it's a blend. It's actually a harmony of all of these, the heart, the mind, the intuition, the intellect, everything working together that makes a great artist like
right.
any
and
great
I,
artist.
I think it's important to push for a new word in the English language, and I don't have one to suggest. But the word that we use for intellect, it seems to have two very different meanings. One meaning is that this discriminating faculty, the one that just looks at something and says, yeah, those two things are different, or I will pick choice A. Mm. And the other is this kind of verbal analytical capacity that we have to talk endlessly about things and get completely absorbed in language and completely lose track of whatever the original experience was. And that's a tendency of language. It marshals all kinds of brain functioning and sucks the neurological activity all over into the left hemisphere and focuses it in these gigantic, monstrous sections of brain matter that are good for talking. And it makes it difficult to get back to simple experience. Mm. And
yeah.
I think that's what makes art so exciting. It throws an experience at you first.
Yeah.
And you can intellectualize about it or not.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.